You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years, a full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. That's what we're talking about today on the Farm Report. You've tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the back of Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we are on the line with one of the network's longtime sponsors, Will Harris of White Oak Pastures. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Aaron. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you on the network. I feel like it's been too long. It's time to connect with old friends. And I know since you were last on, there's been a lot of new stuff happening down at White Oak. So I want to tuck right in. Now, just to give people who maybe aren't totally familiar with you guys a brief overview, can you just give us the lay of the land, the scope of your operation down there?
I'd be happy to. My daughters are the fifth generation of my family to farm this piece of land here in Early County, Georgia. We own 1,000 acres. It's the largest USDA certified organic farm in Georgia, and we rent an additional 1,650 acres. So we've got 2,650 acres where we raise a polyculture of animals. We've got cattle, sheep, goats, and are just introducing hogs. And we also raise several poultry breeds. We've got chickens, turkeys, ducks, geese, guineas. We have built a USDA certified inspected beef abattoir or slaughterhouse on the farm, and more recently a USDA inspected poultry abattoir on the farm. We're the only farm in the country that has both a beef and poultry slaughter plant on the farm, so we're very proud of that.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm curious, making the transition from being a farmer, being a producer, and going into kind of the slaughter business and the processing business as well. I mean, why did you guys decide to take that on as kind of the next project for your farm?
Well, there was never a day that we wanted to be in the animal slaughter business. We backed into that. What happened to us is we were, when my great-grandfather came here, a sustenance farm raising livestock, diverse livestock, slaughtering on the farm and selling it locally. My grandfather did that as well. My father took over the farm after World War II, which is when agriculture really industrialized in this country. And he went from the polyculture of all those animals that I mentioned earlier to a monoculture of cattle, and really became a commodity cattle producer. I went to the University of Georgia, majored in animal husbandry, came back and introduced hormone implants and subtherapeutic antibiotics and confinement feeding of unnatural feedstuffs, and enjoyed industrial farming as a young man, and made money doing it. But when I was in my 40s in the 90s, I guess I became disgusted with the excesses of the industrial practices, and started transitioning back to the ways of my great-grandfather. And the slaughter part came late. The first thing I did was I gave up subtherapeutic hormones and antibiotics and felt really good about that. And then a few years later, I saw the necessity of giving up synthetic fertilizer and pesticides So I did. And a few years later, I saw the need to make a polyculture instead of a monoculture. We can talk more about that later. And then a few years later, I saw the need to do on-farm slaughter. So this whole transformation has been a journey, not a destination. So that's how we got into that.
Into that. And so I'm curious if we can go back in time a little bit. When you were pursuing your degree, it sounds like you came back to the farm kind of armed with all these different tools of the industrial system and the subtherapeutic antibiotics and confinement feeding. I mean, are those practices that they taught you in school, and that was kind of what everyone was doing in school and in the region? Or, I mean, I'm curious, like, how that information came to you and what it looked like. You know, was there pressure to change in that way? Was it recognition of efficiencies or pursuit of, a better profit margin? Or how did they kind of present that to you in the classroom? And then how did you understand that once you kind of got back onto the farm?
That's a good question. And what's true is the entire industry evolved in that direction. Virtually everyone who was in production, agriculture, went in that direction. And those that didn't perished. They went out of business. They went bankrupt. After World War II, a lot of resources from the food industry, from the land-grant colleges, like my own University of Georgia, virtually, everyone who had a vested interest in the production of food really focused on producing food cheap and consistent and safe from the perspective that you didn't die of an acute disease when you ate it. And those were noble goals. I mean, it was important to take cost out of food production so people on a very limited income could eat well. That's very important, was and is. Making food consistent is certainly something that people want. We say consistency can trump quality. People like it to be consistent, even if it's not so good. And certainly safety is an issue. We want to make our food as safe as we possibly can. So the tremendous resources that went to make food cheaper, consistent, and safe, in the acute sense of safe, was tremendous, tremendous resources. Unfortunately, there were unintended consequences of that. Those efforts were wildly successful. Food has become obscenely cheap. I know we've got some spiking food prices now, but generally food is so cheap, particularly in this country. It is consistent. The McDonald's hamburger you get today is just like the one you got yesterday. It may not be all that good, but it's the same hamburger. And people don't die commonly of acute diseases, thank goodness. But the unintended consequences of the success of making food that way was very, very expensive in terms of animal welfare and environmental sustainability. In the effort to make food cheap, consistent, and safe, we forgot about animal welfare. We just lost focus. And we lost about our focus on environmental sustainability, and that's how we got there.
I think I think you really touch on an issue that is so true. I mean, I think post World War II there was a real focus on increasing production, making food more accessible, more affordable, because hunger, was a real issue in the U.S., and increasing production was a real goal, and something I think, top down from the Secretary of Agriculture down, there was a real focus and push behind moving towards these production models. And it's one of those things, I think, where the pendulum just swung a little too far. And it sounds like you confronted that pendulum swing in your mid-40s. You said that you were responding, you know, the changes you decided to make on your farm were a response to what you felt was the excess of the system that you were working with. And can you be a little bit more specific about what that excess was and how it felt and kind of who you looked to for support and guidance as you decided to make these really substantial changes in your operation?
Well, there are a lot of excesses. You know, we'll just talk about animal welfare, and we'll talk about environmental sustainability, just kind of limited to that. From the animal welfare perspective, things like loading 100 500-pound calves that I'd raised on a double-deck semi and shipping them from the coastal plains of Georgia to Colorado or Nebraska to be confinement fed on corn for a few months was really an animal welfare issue that came to bother me. I didn't want to do that. You know, I wanted to keep them here. I have three daughters, and the term I've used is it's like raising your daughters to be princesses and then send them to the whorehouse. You know, I didn't want to send my calves away like that. So that would be an animal welfare, one of many animal welfare issues I could lift up. From an environmental sustainability perspective, I had used chemical fertilizer and pesticides on every acre of land every year, along with some very conventional tillage. And I had literally depleted all the organic matter in my soil. My soil on my farm, that I'm so proud of, had become a dead mineral medium that was only as good as whatever more fertilizer I put out that season. So it's an unintended consequence. And again, I could list many, many more, but those are examples.
And so I'm curious, there are different animal welfare certification agencies. I mean, two come to mind for me in particular, the Certified Humane and Animal Welfare Approved. How do you feel about those certifications as a tool for farmers looking for guidance in transition? And do you participate in either of those programs?
I participate in both of those programs, and I think they're very good. Animal Welfare Approved is very good. Certified Humane is very good. We also participate in the Global Animal Partnership, which is the animal welfare program that Whole Foods initiated. That's a five-step program. All of them are good. All of them have attributes. All of them inspect my farm. And all of them have great big thick books that tell what is good animal welfare, and they're right. But, you know, good animal welfare is very easy to determine. If you enjoy watching the animal, you have good animal welfare. If you would enjoy sitting down on a lawn chair with a glass of wine and watching the animal, the animals need to be able to express their instinctive behavior. Cows were meant to roam and graze. Hogs were meant to root and wallow. Chickens were meant to scratch and peck. Those instinctive behaviors, and if those animals are allowed to express those instinctive behaviors, it's very pleasant to watch them. Nobody but a psychopath enjoys watching a sow in a gestation crate, or chickens in battery cages, or cattle in a feedlot bogging around. So that's, but they're good. All three are good organizations.
Wonderful. And I think it's really lovely to, especially as consumers, it's hard, I think, often to wade through all of kind of the different language and rules and certifications. And I think you put it really well there, where essentially what you want to ask of your food producer is the animal allowed to express the traits that are, you know, intrinsic to its nature. And I think that's a really lovely way to put it. Now, when you were making this transition, did your end market change? I mean, were you selling beef into one system, and then through this transition, you are now selling the stuff you're producing on the farm in a different manner than you were previously?
Absolutely. Previously, we had a monoculture of cattle, and we sold live cattle loaded on a truck delivered to feedlots somewhere. We were just one link in the enormous beef production complex that supplies beef for this country. Today, we are completely vertically integrated. We raise the cattle. The cattle born here, raised here, slaughtered here on the farm. And as is true with the chickens and the turkeys and ducks and geese and sheep. And then we sell them as value-added meat. We have a very active online business at our website, shopping cart, whiteoakpastures.com. Our biggest customer is Whole Foods Markets. They sell our products from Princeton, New Jersey, all the way down to Miami, Florida. And Publix supermarkets, and with some food service distributors, Sysco, Buckhead Beef, Halpern's, sells our beef to food service, to restaurants and such.
Interesting. So we are going to take a short break, but when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more into the diversification of all the different things you have going on the farm and how that was maybe influenced by, you know, the expansion of your own family. But sit tight. We'll be right back after this short break.
Dinner.
Brothers on Heritage Radio Network.org.
In the desert hangs the sun. Sold everything you had to anyone. Suitcase in your hand. Got six or seven.
All right, we are back. You are turned into the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Aaron Fairbanks, and we are on the line with Will Harris of White Oak Pastures. So, Will, I know often in multi-generational farm families, one of the challenges that farms face is as the children become adults and are looking for a way to make a living, and if they want to stay on the farm in many instances has to kind of grow to accommodate, you know, supporting another family's income. And I'm just curious in your family, if that has been the case is as your children have aged, they've pursued different types of activities on the farm and where some of the different directions that you're working on right now have maybe come from, if that's from the family or if it's coming from you or how that's worked for your farm.
Yeah, you know, when you have a family farm, family business of any sort, really, but a family farm is a great example, and children, then the challenge is to create the opportunity for them to come back if they want to, but not create the obligation for them to come back. And one of the things that moving from industrial commodity agriculture into this kinder, softer, gentler agriculture did for me is it allowed me to create really good work for my daughters. I have three daughters, and two of them are back in the business with me. and one as a school teacher, not involved in the business. When I was growing up, I always wanted to run the farm. I didn't want to do anything but run the farm, ever. And I was allowed to do that, so everything went great. Had I not wanted to run the farm, it would have been a problem. If I'd walked in one night and said, I appreciate y'all passing the farm on to me, but really I think I'm going to pursue a career in acting in New York City, it would have gone over like a bug in the punch bowl. But the good news was I never wanted to do anything else. When I had three daughters and the farm had continued to industrialize, it really was not a work situation that I would have wanted them to come back into. It would have been okay, but I don't know that they would have wanted to, and I don't know that I would have wanted them to. But since we evolved into high animal welfare, high environmental stewardship, we don't deal with the big ag companies anymore. We don't deal with Tyson or Cargill or JBS. We deal with individual consumers that appreciate what we do, or with companies like Whole Foods that have an appreciation for the value we put in. And it was a great place for my daughters to come back, and they've done so. And by the way, when I was operating this as a commodity cattle farm, I had three employees, none of whom made a lot of money. Today, we've got 85 employees. We're the largest privately owned employer in this county. And we've got great people, and I think we provide quality jobs. Nobody makes minimum wage. Everybody's on a bonus program. We have subsidized health insurance. We feed lunch to everybody every day. So it's a good workplace.
Yeah, I was curious about that because I know often in discussions around the food system, the term vertical integration is often looked at as a negative, as large companies or conglomerates of companies kind of taking ownership out of the hands of people in communities. And so, why is it that you feel like that's the right terminology for your business? And I mean, how would you respond to critique of that system?
Good. That's a great question. I've never been asked that before, but luckily I do have the answer. Vertical integration has always, in the food business, been considered to be bad, and there are reasons why. That is the centralization of the food. It represented the centralization of our food production system in this country. We now brag about the fact that we are vertically integrated at this farm at White Oak Pastures, and that's because it is part of decentralizing the food system. And so what we're talking about here is top-down vertical integration, which is what the industrialization was, where large multinational companies have huge slaughter plants that process as many as 400 head of cattle per hour, 16 hours a day, out of feedlots with over 100,000 head of cattle, and the vertical integration goes on from there. Ours is bottom-up vertical integration. We are a family farm, 146-year-old family farm that my family owns 100%. And we have returned to the production methods of my great-grandfather, raising the animals here, slaughtering them here, and distributing them from here. So it's both of them are vertical integration, no question about it, but it's top-down centralization versus bottom-up decentralization.
Excellent. Thank you. On that note, you guys have recently added the chicken processing facility, and you were just we were just chatting for a minute before the show started. You also have a fledgling, I don't know, restaurant in quotation marks happening on the property. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
No, I will. We it's brand new. We I mentioned a minute ago, we've got 85 great employees that I like every single one of them. And we bring that. By the way, we're very rural here. We're 12 miles from the nearest place to get something to eat, and it's a fast food restaurant. So you know, we bring these guys way out here in the country. We work hard here. This is very, very physical work. Everything we do here is very physical. And we work at least 10 hours a day, very often 12 hours a day. And there just wasn't time for them to quit and go to town and get something to eat. And the something to eat they got was not very nourishing. So we started, we hired someone to cook the food and bring it to them here. And that helped a little bit. But, you know, a 240-pound cowboy or butcher eating out of a little styrofoam plate in his lap is not a pretty sight. So, and I'm talking about me as a 240-pound cowboy. But we built an open pavilion, sort of like a church dinner-on-the-ground pavilion, for them to eat under on picnic tables. And then we were struggling to get the food brought in, so we built a 20-by-20-foot industrial kitchen. And we've now got our restaurant license, and we eat lunch together every day, and I really like it. It's, you know, you go down there, there's an accountant sitting by a cowboy, sitting by a butcher, sitting by a vegetable farmer, sitting by a clerk, and it's a lot of togetherness, and it's the way it ought to be. There are no waiters or waitresses. You walk up to the window and get your food, and you don't order. There's no menu. You don't order. You say yes or no, because we cook a meat that we raise on this farm and slaughter on this farm, and three vegetables that are grown on this farm, and eggs that are produced on this farm. So pretty much everything but the salt and the sugar and the tea and the coffee are here. We call it pasture to plate.
Now, I'm just curious, because you live in the midst of this kind of bounty, and I think one of the things that people who have a more urban living often feel jealous of, or I know I feel jealous of, is, you know, when you're kind of getting to go to the refrigerator or freezer and choose from essentially any cut of meat from this, you know, menagerie of animals. I mean, is there a cut or a breed or anything in particular that you really go to that's like your favorite kind of farm dinner that's the comfort food for you?
Well, yeah, I'm a beef guy, and I like. So that's my default meal would be beef. And as far as individual cuts, you know, it's all good if it's cooked right. And I'm thrilled that we are reentering an era in which we are relearning how to utilize the whole carcass. You know, my mother, who was born in 1920, is deceased. And she could cook anything on a cow, from the tongue to the oxtail. She could cook anything, and it was good. And my wife, who was born in the 50s, does a great job with all the steaks and roasts and ground beef. And she raised three daughters who were born in the 80s. And they, until recently, couldn't cook anything except maybe a hamburger. But because of the great works being done by so many of these chefs, and we got a lot of them here in Atlanta that are focused on farm-to-table whole carcass utilization, that one of my daughters can now cook beef tongue and oxtail and sheep testicles, and it's good. It's really good.
That's exciting. So not only a resurgence on your farm to more traditional farming practices, but also a resurgence of cooking and cooking skills. And obviously those things go hand in hand. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really lovely to get a chance to speak with you. And I also wanted to say congratulations. I see here that the Georgia Conservancy will be recognizing you as their 2012 Distinguished Conservationist for your dedication to advancing sustainable and organic farming in Georgia. I know they're holding a benefit later in October. And for those of you listening, if you want to learn more about White Oak Pastures, I believe, Will, you have done a few small films, right?
Well, the Southern Foodways Alliance did a great film on our farm, and then there's some others, and all of them are on our website, which is whiteoakpastures.com.
So definitely check those out and tune in next week as we bring you another episode of the Farm Report. Don't worry if you miss us live. All of our episodes are available through iTunes or on Stitcher. You can learn more about Heritage Radio Network by visiting us, www.heritageradionetwork.org. We hope if you enjoy the show, you will click to support us and become a member today, and tune in next week for another episode of the Farm Report.
What's hot at the green market? You're about to find out now. It's the Grow NYC Market Update.
Thanks for listening to the Farm Report. This is actually Jack Inslee filling in for Aaron Fairbanks, and this is the Grow NYC Market Update. I'm on the phone with Gene Hodish, publicity coordinator for the Grow NYC Market Update, and every week we find out what's hot, what's on the way out, what's exciting, what's new, what's not to miss, and upcoming events. So, Gene, what's going on this week at the market?
Hi, Jack. Well, we are happy to be on the phone with you, and I am sorry to say that the weather has cooled off, and the summer fruit is on the way out. There's still plenty of it in the market, but we're nearing the end of that season. And I was just thinking, I was at a wedding this weekend, and the bride and groom, instead of having a big wedding cake, they asked all the guests to bring pies, which is the perfect application for end-of-summer stone fruit. So you could make peach pies, berry pies, add apples to them to make them a bit, you know, pump them up a bit. I saw somebody made a tomato pie. And as I was thinking about it, pie is something so great to think about when you're at the market, because you can also get flour and you can get lard and butter from different vendors. So you can make an all-local pie to serve to your family and friends. But coming in, things that I saw this week in the markets that are new, a couple weeks back on this show I was talking about quince, and they're in now. So you can pick them up at Locust Grove, which is at Union Square a couple days a week, and also at 97th Street on Fridays. And when you go over to look at their quince, be sure you check out their different varieties of heirloom apples. You will find things you have never heard of before. Russets, for instance, are this really kind of gnarly-looking apple that has a super rough skin. It's not waxy or polished like the ones you'll find in bodegas or the grocery store. And it's a flavor unlike anything you've had. They're super crunchy. They're really sweet. They don't look really beautiful, but they are definitely worth a try. So this week we also saw horseradish root, and this is one of my personal favorite roots because the flavor is so like pungent and biting and completely overwhelming. It'll clear out your nostrils. It's really hot. And as I was thinking about it, I mean, I love making Bloody Marys at home, and I was thinking, actually, this is a really good time of year to make an all-local Bloody Mary. You could make your own horseradish to add in. You could make tomato juice with the tomatoes. You can add celery. You could get some pickles and some pickle brine from Rick's Picks, like smokra and mean beans are really delicious in a Bloody Mary. So that's something that I think I might have to try this weekend. And actually, it's also still, you know, a great season to be canning. Rick actually put out a book a couple years ago called The Art of Preserving, and he'll have recipes in there for smokra, mean beans, and there are plenty of ingredients in the market like haricot vert and garlic and all kinds of hot peppers that you can throw in a jar and have your pickles for the months ahead. The other thing I wanted to mention was that tonight is Harvest in the Square, which is an event, a benefit tasting event for the Union Square Partnership. We work with a lot at Union Square. And there are tons of neighborhood restaurants that come, but Green Market always sets up a table, and tonight we're going to be serving a carrot apple beet slaw. So if anyone who's listening is heading to the event, please make sure to stop by and say hello. And if you're not, think about that. Carrot apple beet slaw is pretty easy to make at home, all with ingredients that are in season right now. Something not to miss, my roommate the other night made for dinner an eggplant parmesan, and it was so delightful, so delicious. We have tons of varieties of eggplant in the market, everything from little fairy tale eggplants, which are, you know, about 2 or 3 inches long, to long, thin Japanese eggplant, to white eggplant, and then, of course, the large purple beauties that come in from the field at the end of the summer. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, it was still really hot. I wouldn't have ever thought about turning on my oven to roast anything, but now that the chill of fall is in the air, I'm spending more time in the kitchen. And this eggplant parmesan, it was like the eggplant was just velvety. It was so luscious, and then she'd made this homemade tomato sauce and spread it around and put fresh basil in there, and it was just fantastic. And she was telling me she'd gone to Grand Army Plaza that weekend and found a bag of tomatoes for $4. It's heading towards the end of tomato season. You can find some really good deals out there, so it's a great time to make tomato sauce.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So upcoming, so it's, like I said, it's getting colder. And that always makes me start thinking about throwing dinner parties. So when I think about how I'm going to serve my friends when they come over, I start to think about proteins in a way that I really don't when it's hotter outside, getting back again to not wanting to turn on the oven. But now that it's a little chillier outside, you know, I'm thinking about roasting chicken on Sunday afternoon, also thinking about, you know, slow-braised meats. So a couple years ago, I remember I was having a dinner party. I really wanted to get a roast chicken, but all of the chicken vendors at the market were out that day. So I wandered around and found Karen Weinberg, who has Three Corner Field Farm, and said, you know, I'm having this dinner party. It's this many people. What might you suggest? And she came up. She said, why don't you serve lamb neck? People don't think about serving that often. So I would suggest that if you're thinking about having a dinner party, you want to serve some meat, go around, talk to the different meat purveyors. Tell them, you know, sort of an idea that you have, and they'll come back to you probably with suggestions of maybe some offcuts that they've got that you wouldn't think of right off the bat. So lamb neck, I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It was really delicious. And then we just slow braised it, and then you can throw in all kinds of root vegetables and onions and make a really nice, tender dish.
That sounds amazing. And it's also almost Goat-tober, so at Heritage here we have to send out a plug for the goats if you guys can find any goat out there. Sounds like that could work well, too.
Absolutely.
And do you guys have any good events coming up soon?
We do. I wanted to tell everybody about New Green City, which is going to take place at the south end of Union Square on October 10th. It's a Wednesday. So the market will be in full swing in the north end of the park, and then in the south end we'll have all kinds of community partners, everybody from the new school to certified naturally grown to representation of all of Grow NYC's sister programs along with Green Market. So people will be set up engaging visitors with activities from apple tastings to the new school's going to lead some pop-up classes. We'll have information about the city's bike share program. So it should be really fun and lively. And if you're anywhere near Union Square on October 10th, it's happening from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So stop by, say hello. We'd love to see you.
Well, Gene, that's an awesome update. So for all the listeners, you want to make some pie with those end-of-the-summer fruits. The quince is really hot right now, and do not miss the eggplants. I can personally attest to those little fairy tale eggplants. They're delicious. So great tips for all of our listeners. Thank you so much. This has been the Grow NYC Market Update. And if you want more information on farmers, the market, or volunteer opportunities, check out grownyc.org and follow them on Twitter at Union Square Green Market, but that's spelled UNSQ Green Market, and at NYC Green Markets. Again, this has been Jack Inslee with the Farm Report and the Grow NYC Market Update with Gene Hodesh, Publicity Coordinator for Grow NYC. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network.
You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.